Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Deborah Kopaykin has always had many roles in her life, but there's been one constant over the past 20-odd years, and that's been as a parent. The former photojournalist, war photographer, and writer has always balanced family and career, even taking jobs outside of her career arc to pay her kids' college tuition, and written about her life as a parent, first in a book of comic essays some years ago, Hell as Other Parents, which was later adapted into a stage production, but now in a more contemplative view of parenting, titled The ABCs of Parenthood, which combines essays along with her photography. Kopaykin is the author of two novels, Between Here and Now and The Red Book, which was a New York Times bestseller. She's also written a memoir of her time as a wartime photographer titled Shuttle Babe. She joins us today to talk about her parenting experiences and how to talk about difficult subjects with your children. Deborah Kopaykin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Your book, The ABCs of Parenthood, follows up on a previous book on the ABCs of adulthood, but your book is full of common sense advice for parents. I wonder if you have any special advice for parents today, given the fact that you're seeing, you know, mass shootings, fires in California, hurricanes, about how to talk to children about events like this.
You know, I have an 11-year-old, so I have firsthand experience with this right now. And I would say it's important not to lie to children, but to tell the truth doesn't mean telling the entire truth. There are areas of these types of horrific events that can be left out. Now, for one, let me just say right off the bat, I do not have the TV on in the background. We do not watch CNN, we do not watch Fox, we do not watch MSNBC, we do not watch any of that. So, first of all, keep the TVs off, because what cable news will do is just sort of hype up the news in a way that is really destructive to a child's psyche. But the second thing we do is I kind of let the information come from my son. I have two older ones, 22 and 20. They're old enough to talk about these things in general. But for the 11-year-old, I'll let him ask the questions at dinner time. I mean, one of the letters we have in our book, F is for Family Dinner, is all about the importance of family dinner and the importance of those discussions that happen around the family dinner, because otherwise they don't happen. And we try to speak to the child's age, meaning an 11-year-old can understand a lot more than a 5-year-old, but he's not an adult yet in any way, shape, or form. So I try to meet him where he is, and that also is part of our book, which is about acceptance. You meet your child where they are at that particular moment in time, at that particular person in time, that a lot of times we try to make our children grow up too quickly, or we try to keep them from growing up. And the point of parenthood and the real joy and art of parenthood that nobody ever teaches you, because we don't have classes on this, is to meet your child where they are, to accept them. A is for acceptance. Accept your child for who they are at that moment in time that they are that person.
I loved your entry for C, which is C is for cucumber.
Yeah, C is for cucumber. Now, I wrote this book with my good friend, artist, Randy Palumbo, and this was his idea, and I thought it was brilliant. I didn't understand it at first, but C is for cucumber means once a pickle, never a cucumber again. In other words, if you're going to take your kid who's 7 years old to an R-rated movie, you should expect to bear those consequences. Children, innocence only lasts for a short period of time. And not that we should keep our children innocent forever, but there's no point in ruining that innocence with the hideous parts of the world, be they wars, overly sexual things, or anything that will ruin a child's innocence too early. That's not our job. Our job is to keep our children as innocent as possible for as long as possible until they're ready to ask the questions. You know, let's even go for the idea of, you know, where do babies come from? In each case, with each of my three children, I allowed them to ask that question. I wasn't going to sort of pipe up with that information. And each of them asked at very different times. You know, my eldest asked when he was 3 years old, and we tried to keep it very simple. My middle one asked when she was about 7 years old, and the little one never asked at all. And finally, you know, when he was about 10, I said, you know, you do know where babies come from, right? And he said, yeah, my brother and sister told me. So,
Now, you've written, this is your second book on parenthood. I think the first one was sort of a more of a humorous take. What made you decide to write about parenthood?
The origin of all of these series of books, and it's supposed to be a larger series. The first one was the ABCs of Adulthood. This one's called the ABCs of Parenthood. The next one in the series is the ABCs of Love, as yet unwritten. Don't tell my publisher. But they started with a letter to my son as he was leaving for college. He was turning 18. He was leaving for college. And all of a sudden, as a parent, I thought, oh, my goodness, there's all this stuff I haven't told him. And yet, at the same time, I'm not going to sort of sit on his bed and, like, say, oh, by the way, you need to know this and you need to know that. I thought, let me just write a letter that I will include in a present for his graduation. And when I started writing the letter got longer and longer and longer. And I thought, okay, I'm going to just turn this into an alphabet. That way I will limit myself. I will not go on too long, but I can also expand. And so 26 letters of the alphabet felt adequate in terms of the advice I was going to be able to give an 18-year-old boy who really doesn't want to hear advice from his parents in the first place. That letter that I wrote to him, I ended up publishing on a website that is since defunct. That letter went viral, and then I met with publisher Christine Carswell at Chronicle, and we decided to turn it into a book with images that I would shoot and that my co-author Randy Palumbo would shoot. And so then with this second book, Randy and I are both parents. And I raised three kids, he raised one kid, and we sat down over breakfast and we said, what do we know about parenting aside from the mistakes that we've made? Because we're not parenting experts. Yeah, I mean, we're writers, we're artists, we're people who raise children. And we thought, well, let's start from those mistakes and move on from there, because if we can keep parents from making the same mistakes that we made, that's half the battle. And then from there we decided, you know, both of us have read a lot. I've read a lot about psychology and Buddhism and mindful parenting, and I thought, what I really like in the entire parenting schema of books are books that focus on mindful parenting, like The Blessings of a Skinned Knee. That's a beautiful book about parenting. And the idea of that book is, you know, let your child fall. Let them skin their knee. Let them learn from their mistakes. And in the same way, we're trying to teach parents to learn from our mistakes. We, as parents, have raised kids to adulthood, or two of mine are adults, and one of Randy's are adults, and we made mistakes along the way. And we tried in each letter to correct those mistakes. So, for example, let's take Y is for yelling, right? I've yelled at my kids. Randy yelled at his kids. Yelling's bad. And you know that yelling's bad the minute you yell, because you feel terrible. And what we said in our book is, try not to holler at your kid. But if you do, then please get on your knees, look that child in the eyes, and say, I am sorry. I am sorry I lost my temper. That was wrong. You must have felt scared. It's really important that when we make mistakes as parents, we let the children know that we are fallible and that we atone for that fallibility.
Recently, you wrote a piece on Facebook that actually got you banned temporarily. Before we talk about that, it was involved the hashtag Me Too.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
How would you talk to your kids about that if your kids ask you about that, say an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old?
So I am not going to talk to my 11-year-old about Me Too at the moment. But once my son and daughter, my older son and daughter, turned adolescent, we had lively discussions around the dinner table, very open and lively discussions about sexual assault, because I was sexually assaulted when I was in college. And the point of these discussions to both my son and my daughter was to start to talk about consent. And what does consent mean? And what is the definition of sexual assault? How are women mistreated in society? How are bosses... How do bosses misuse their power and treat women differently than they treat men? How is it that women are paid still 77 cents to the dollar? I'm a staunch feminist. Let there not be any question about that. And part of my feminism was being so open about the idea of consent and the idea of rape and what those things mean to our society and to women, and particularly to my daughter, but also to my son, that at one point my son pulled me aside because his friend Luca was over for dinner and we were having this discussion about assault. And he said, you're embarrassing me in front of Luca. And so I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And I went to Luca specifically alone and I said, Luca, I'm so sorry that I embarrassed you at dinner talking about these topics. And he said, no, I really enjoyed it. I in fact, I sort of wanted to talk more about it, but I could tell that Jacob was feeling uncomfortable. So, you know, it's a fine line. It's a fine line between ramming things down a kid's throat, you know, all of your ideas and concepts about how the world works in terms of male and female behaviors, and also just sort of learning, as I should have, to time my conversations to moments when perhaps it wouldn't cause embarrassment.
But that's an amazing family dinner table if you can talk about these subjects, because most of the time, most families will not.
That's a choice that we make as parents, and I don't necessarily think my choice is the right choice. It's the choice that I decided to make, and once I made that choice, that was a choice about truth-telling and about not trying to hide the hard parts of life and, in fact, talking about them before they might become an issue for each of my children. Now, for example, I had a son and a daughter who were 21 months apart, and they were both at an age where they could travel alone on the subway. And we had specifically not imposed curfews on our children because I don't believe in curfews. I believe in talking through all of this. I believe that when a child is at a party and is going to be home a little late, and we live farther away than most kids, by the way. We lived up in Harlem at the time, and everybody else lived, you know, in the middle of Manhattan. I would say to my kids, just let me know where you are at around 11:30, 12. Let's try to come up with a reasonable time to be home, but I'm not going to penalize you for being a minute late or 3 minutes late or 5 minutes late. But I also want to know that you're safe and that if it's 1 a.m, I really don't want you traveling on public transportation. And then we got into this discussion of how it was more important for my daughter not to travel on public transportation than my son, and the unfairness of that, because it was going to cost her more of her own babysitting money to get home, because, you know, I don't have a curfew, but if you're going to take a taxi home, that's your own pocket, because that's a decision you've made to come home later than 11:30 when it's reasonable and not dangerous on the subway. And how unfair that my daughter is going to spend more money to be safe than my son would, because he doesn't care taking the subway at 2 a.m. And, you know, after a while, I realized that that was actually a penalty I was placing on her, that she was spending more of her babysitting money. And I said, you know what, every once in a while, I will pay for that taxi.
Now, you're talking about kids in their adolescent
yep.
years for riding the subway alone. When you started talking about the subway, it reminded me of the columnist Lenore Skenazy, who let her 9-year-old. Her 9-year-old approached her and said, I want to ride the subway home from school one day. And
yep.
She was branded America's worst parent for taking this incredible risk in what was really a decision of the child wanting to be independent. I wonder how you would react to that if your 9-year-old said, I want to ride the subway home from school.
Well, first of all, I have an 11-year-old who rides the subway back and forth to school, a long distance. So that gives you some indication. He goes to a school in the East Village, and we now live up in Inwood, which is the northern tip of Manhattan. So it's an hour-long commute with a subway change between the A train and the L train, and he does it. He does travel with his friend, another friend that goes to the same school, but he said he was ready to do it. You know, I don't push these things, but when a child says, I'm ready to take the subway by myself, that's all I need to know, because he's grown up in New York City. He knows, and we've talked about stranger danger. We've talked about what happens if some creepy man or creepy person comes up to you and tries to get in your business. We've talked about hiding your cell phone in your backpack. We've talked about not giving your name away to people who ask for it. They know, you know. And so if they want to take on that responsibility at 11, I didn't let him ride the subway at 9, but he did walk to school by himself at 9, which was, you know, 4 blocks away from where we live, because he said he was ready. And I also happen to live in a neighborhood, unusual for Manhattan, but the neighborhood I live in has a park. And this park is where all the children gather after school. And it really feels like living in 1950s America because, you know, parents in the 60s and 70s and 80s stopped sending their kids out by themselves. But in our neighborhood, the kids come home from school. They all meet up at this park. It's not even a playground. There's nothing to play on. There's just trees and grass and sort of like a village green. And the kids go unaccompanied, and it's fine.
You know, you talk about that being a throwback to the 50s and 60s. I wonder what our children are missing by not having that sort of freedom.
A lot. A lot. And when you talk about Lenore Skenazy, who I adore, I don't know her personally, but I adore her writing, and I adore what she's doing out in the world, which is saying, hey, you know, I mean, one of the letters in our book is H is for helicopter, and we admonish parents who are helicopter parents because, you know, when I dropped my son off at college, the college president said, parenting has gotten so insane that he often has to field calls from parents who want to talk about their child's papers in freshman year. And one parent was so crazy. I mean, this is a story that was told at Northwestern, my kid's college. One parent was so crazy that they moved in with their child into their dorm room for a month until the school got wind of it and said, you can't live with your child. You know, our job as parents is very simple, as I see it. Our job as parents is to teach our children how to be on their own, to help them learn independence. That's our sole job, and it takes very different forms when they're toddlers, when they're preteens, when they're tweens, when they're teenagers. That parenting looks very different at different ages, but the end goal is still the same, independence. And helicopter parenting is anathema to that. Hovering over your child, doing their homework, writing their college essays. You know, to me, it's created a generation of kids who get to college and have no idea how to do anything on their own.
My guest today is Deborah Kopakin. She's an author and photojournalist and the co-author of The ABCs of Parenthood. It's published by Chronicle Books. It's a beautiful book to give to a new parent, beautiful photography, as well as short essays on each letter of the alphabet. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, before we talk about your hashtag MeToo experience, sure. I want to ask about T is for telephone. This is a challenge that even a generation ago, parents didn't have to deal with. The telephone, the electronic device that is constantly with all of us, parents and children alike.
And I'm as guilty as the next person of that addiction, and I wish I could curb it. And I guess the only way to curb it is, so for example, at F is for family dinner, your cell phone is not allowed. So all cell phones have to be turned off or put in another room. You cannot hear them blink or make their trilling sounds or whatever they do. You cannot answer text. I don't care how vital it is. I don't care if it's your boyfriend or your girlfriend. No, no phones at dinner. So that's one rule we've imposed. But also, I would say it's more parents looking into the screens of their phones than kids. You know, kids are accused of this being the worst generation of children who are just staring into their phones. I'm sorry. When I look at a playground, it's the parents who are the worst offenders. And so I think it's really important just to recognize that this is an addiction, that we have to curb it, and I don't know, we should be all going to like AA for cell phone addiction and doing a 12-step for cell phone addiction. Who knows? I don't have the answer to that, but I just know that I just try. I'm always trying not to be on my phone.
My guest today is Deborah Kopakin. Her new book is titled The ABCs of Parenthood. It's published by Chronicle Books. You just had an incident where you shared hashtag Me Too in the wake of Harvey Weinstein and everything else going on. And you actually banned from Facebook for a couple of days.
It was such a weird and sort of re-traumatizing surprise. I'm still processing it. So what happened was Sunday night, I'm going to sleep. I log on to Facebook and I see all these women posting Me Too. I hadn't heard of it. I click on the hashtag. I find out Alyssa Milano had said, let's all of us post stories of our own abuse and harassment and predation to show men in our feed what it's like being a woman. And I thought, oh, that's a brilliant idea. I will share my Me Too. And, you know, I have hundreds of which to choose from, as do most of my female friends. I don't know a single female friend who has not had an incident of Me Too in her life. But my specific Me Too was when I was a college student between 1984 and 88. I had a number of sort of really violent incidents. So I was mugged at gunpoint twice. I was sitting in my dorm room typing a Shakespeare paper when a man broke into my room and threatened to rape me. I was sexually assaulted on the last night of my school. There were many, many incidents. So I was a photography major at the time, and my response to all that, because after the man broke into my room, I actually became paralyzed, meaning emotionally paralyzed. I didn't want to leave my room. I didn't want to be in my room. I didn't want to be out in the street. I was just afraid of my own shadow. And I talked with my photography professor, the most amazing man, this guy named Christopher James, who's still alive and still teaching, I think, in Boston right now. He's just an incredible man. And we talked through that trauma and came up with an idea, which was I would go into areas that are specifically dangerous to women, which, you know, at the time, what I could reach by subway or by the T where I was living was red light districts. So I'd go to areas that women are told to keep out of, which are red light districts. And when I would go to those red light districts, dressed absolutely in the plainest of clothes, I would wear a T-shirt, I would wear my photojournalist vest, jeans, sneakers, hair in a ponytail. I was not dressed in any way suggestively. Not that that is a open invitation, by the way, men, to harass women, but I specifically dressed neutrally just as an experimental part of this, which was I wanted to see if men would harass me, and if they did harass me, what I would do is I would turn the tables on them. So I would go to these red light districts, and every single time I went, somebody would say, "Hey, baby, looking hot," or "Hey, baby, want to get it on," or "Hey, baby," whatever the heck they wanted to say that day. You know, in my 20s, I got it all the time. I would say, "No, I don't want to get it on, sir, but I would like to shoot your photograph." And at the time, I only had a 28-millimeter lens on a Nikkormat. That's all I could afford. So I had this 28-millimeter lens, which doesn't shoot portraits very well. So I would have to get super close to the person, like literally in their face, 5 inches from their skin to take a portrait. So what it did was it reversed the dynamic of predation. All of a sudden, I was the hunter instead of the prey. And that was my senior thesis from college. That senior thesis went on to win awards. It was a finalist for the W. Jean Smith Award. It got exhibited at the first Perpignan Photojournalism Festival in Perpignan, France. It's called Visa pour l'Image. And it got my foot in the door to be the war photographer that I then became for several years. So I thought for my Me Too post, I would post 2 photos from that series. The only 2 photos where I caught the predation in the act. Meaning, normally somebody would say to me, "Hey, baby, want to get it on?" I'd say no, and I would take this really close-up photograph, and that was my photographic means of showing this. But in 2 images from that series, one was a group of men in wolf masks who chased me down a Boston street. And that wasn't even in the red light district. That was just on a normal street. And the other was a man who'd said to me, "Hey, baby, want to get it on?" I'd say no, I'd like to shoot your photo. But before I could get close enough to his face, he flashed me. And so I stood back about 5 feet from this man, shot a photo of the flasher, and ran. So those are the 2 photos I shot because, really, I mean, the insidious part of sexual predation is its silence and invisibility. And what I wrote in this article in Medium was that it's like Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street. You know, we're all these women, we're like big birds, and we have this giant mastodon of sexual predation that we see every day, but when we try to tell somebody about it, it's gone. It doesn't exist. So everybody believes Big Bird's lying about Snuffleupagus, and everybody believes women are lying about predation. So here were 2 documentary proof of sexual predation in photographs. And I wrote a quick line. I just said, "Me too, too many times to count, and I even have photographic evidence," something like that. It was like 2 lines. And I posted the 2 photos, and I went to sleep. It was like 10 o'clock at night. At midnight, I get a text on my phone that wakes me up saying, you know, "Alert, alert, you've been banned from Facebook." And I thought, what? And I was too tired to sort of like pay attention. And I went back to sleep and I woke up the next morning furious. I thought, I cannot believe I've been kicked off from Facebook. They said for promoting sexual violence and that they were going to pass on my information to law enforcement in certain instances. And I said, you know, first of all, I was not promoting sexual violence. I was unmasking it. And second of all, they didn't leave a phone number or an email or anything. You know, Facebook, when they kick you off, they don't allow you to say, "Yo, wait a minute, this is wrong." So for a day, I just went on Twitter. I said, "Hey, I was kicked off Facebook." You feel like this sort of desperate animal, you know, "Oh no, I've lost my platform." Then Tuesday morning, as I was feeding my son breakfast, and I was back on Facebook. I was finally allowed back on Facebook. I was typing a Facebook status update to explain what had happened. And then I realized, I'm not going to type this on Facebook because I want to show those photos. I want to show what got me kicked off. So if I do that here, I'm going to get kicked off again. So I have a Medium account, you know, medium.com, right, which is sort of a publishing platform. And I decided, well, I'll just put this on Medium. And I went on Medium, and I thought, oh, well, Medium's such a beautiful platform. I'm going to put a few more of the photos from that series on there. And I literally just like wrote the Facebook update that I would have put on Facebook but couldn't because I was going to get kicked off, you know, the catch-22. put that on Medium, hit publish, got my kid off to school and finished feeding him breakfast, and thought nothing of it. I just published on Medium, posted that post to Facebook. It went nuts. I mean, I've had things go viral in the past, but this thing is up to 91,000 views. That's a lot of views for what was supposed to just be a Facebook post. And I think it really hit a nerve, and it got passed around and published and republished and republished, because the whole point of Me Too is to make visible the invisible. And here was this giant behemoth, Facebook, kicking me off for doing so. And I think that just really hit a nerve in a lot of people. Now, to their credit, an employee of Facebook saw the Medium post, contacted his boss, I suppose, or whoever was in charge of this, and got, not only was I reinstated in Facebook, but he reposted the original post. So that's up, and anyone can go to my Facebook page, which is Deborah Kopaykin, and check it out if they want. So that's great that they responded that quickly, but would they have responded that quickly had I not suddenly had a viral post on Medium that has now been shared 91,000 times? I don't think so. And so, you know, I'm lucky to have a platform, and I think that for the New York Times article about Harvey Weinstein, the reason that the women have been coming out of the woodwork is because some of the more famous actresses came out of the woodwork. You have Angelina Jolie, you have Gwyneth Paltrow, you have Ashley Judd saying, this happened to me, and that empowers all of us to say, you know what, it happened to me too. And that's the beauty of Me Too, and that's the insanity of having been kicked off of Facebook.
I found the whole project that you did so many years ago so interesting. Shooting Back, I think, was the name of that project. It's amazing that a 30-year-old project still has resonance today. It's unfortunate, too.
Yes, amazing and sad. Amazing and really sad, because I guess doing that work back then as a 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old, I thought, by the time my daughter is born, if I am lucky enough to have one, this has got to change. This has just got to change. And no, it hasn't. And Me Too is a wonderful start. But the next step, you know, as in Black Lives Matter, is real fundamental institutional change. And I think that's going to be harder and longer and a much more of an uphill battle. And I'll bring this back for a second, by the way, to the ABCs of parenthood, which is that all this is about boundaries. And in our book, we have B is for boundaries. You know, if only parents could teach their children proper boundaries. And you teach proper boundaries by showing them yourself. So you teach a child a proper boundary by not going in the bathroom when they're going into the bathroom. And you teach them proper boundaries by not allowing them in your bedroom at night. Those are physical boundaries. You also teach children proper boundaries by, when they say, when they come home from school, hey, I don't feel like talking about that, you respect that boundary. What sexual predation is, at its core, is breaking boundaries. And so if we could all, males, females, transgenders, however you define yourself, if we could all focus in our lives, in our professional lives, in our personal lives, on keeping boundaries sacred, that would go a very long way to solving many of the world's problems.
Deborah Kopaykin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Rich.
Writer and photojournalist Deborah Kopaykin speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest book is titled The ABCs of Parenthood, which is published by Chronicle Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.